Howdy. David has designed so many games, both on his own and with collaborators. You've probably seen his work in the Undaunted series, Valiant Defense series, and most recently in Sniper Elite and Resist. We chat about collaborative design and immersive player experience. Your first three games in the Valiant Defense series, you know, you've got Pavlov, Soldiers and Postman's Uniforms, and Kessel Itter, covering some pretty unique history, like some kind of very weird premises, if you will. So what was Dan Versen's reaction when you told him your fourth game was going to be a Bulge game? I was just kind of curious.
For better or worse, Dan kind of doesn't care what I do, right? Like, I'm in this really weird, interesting relationship with DVG, with Dan specifically, where I can kind of just do whatever I want, you know? And this is, that's a, both a, you know, pro and a con, right? But he's really supportive of me just kind of doing whatever I want to do. And so whether that's even by Stealth and Sea, which is like super... also hyper niche, you know. He's been super supportive of whatever. So when I came to him with Lansworth Ridge, I mean, I don't want to speak for Dan. My guess is that Dan's like, oh, that's nice. That'll probably sell better than, you know, Soldiers in Postman's Uniform. But he was just super supportive with it. So yeah.
You can see the refinements each volume of that series. I was kind of curious, do you think your design approach has changed since your first one, or do you think it's more of a just overall net of design experience that's kind of informed that?
Yeah, I think so for sure it's design experience. I think that the approach is probably, like, for sure I've learned a lot about myself, right? I mean, you know, when I was designing Kessel Itter, because it was the first in the series to be designed, that's when I was just really starting to get into design works, right? So we're talking like 2017-ish. And, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, right? Like, I was all over the place at the time. If you go back and look at the games I was designing at that point, it really was all over the place. And I think maybe subconsciously I knew kind of what I wanted to do, but I don't know that I could have articulated it at the time. And I think for me, I've learned a lot about myself. I've learned a lot about what I think I'm good at, capable of doing. And I think as a, you know, sort of a natural part of that process about me learning about myself, there's been a natural sort of organic evolution of refinement to that. So I think about all the time, you know, if I went back and redesigned Kessel Itter knowing what I know now, it would look more alike to Lansworth Ridge than it does, right? And maybe that's good or bad or whatever, but there's certainly fiddly bits of Kessel Itter that could be shaved off for sure, right? For the better, I think.
I think it's weird because some of it is like, it's a little fuzzy charm, you know, when you get back in your kind of older game and stuff like that. Like, it's like, yeah, it's like, there's little elements of it there, of course, but at the same time too, like some things, you know, when you're approaching your games from a standpoint, sometimes like, oh, there's a complexity budget and I don't want to go over budget. Sometimes I'll prevent some really chromy exceptions that players really don't care if you leave those out, but it's just like, I care a lot, everything. But I always find it fascinating when I talk with a designer and they're telling me like that, they talk about like one of their first designs or even like just something they designed like 5-10 years ago. And they're like, oh, I wouldn't, if I did that now, I wouldn't change anything. And I'm just always like I submit something, like I hit send and like, I would already take something back immediately.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because, again, this is a really good example of knowing more about yourself and what you appreciate and stuff. So I kind of live in two worlds when I'm designing. One world is the designing in the world of like War Chest and Undaunted, right? That are clearly, the demographic is a broader audience. And then designing for the solitaire war game community, which is super niche. And so I there is no Chrome budget in Undaunted, right? Like, there's just not. There can't be. And so you just shave it down and shave it down and shave it down. But in like Lansworth Ridge, like you said, I have this, I think it's a great phrase, a Chrome budget. And but I would say now my Chrome budget is much, I'm much more conscious about it, right? So with Castle Itter, I'll come up with something like, okay, how do I simulate getting a tennis player to jump over the wall and escape? And like, there's all this sort of like subsystems built around that, right?
Yeah.
And then, but in Lansworth Ridge, it's like, okay, these are the things that have to exist in the game, but how can I craft one single subsystem to allow for these different historical events, right? So trying to just approach it, you know, it's still Chromey, but you're trying to approach it in a better, a more efficient way, or, you know, however you want to look at it.
You know, so the title of yours that's been sitting on my table the most probably in the past month has been Resist. I became pretty obsessed with it because having designed my own game, well, I shouldn't say my own because I'm designing with two other people and they did, you know, a lot of work on it. So, but having designed a resistance in France during World War II, like during the occupation game, I'm always really curious to see how other designers are going to approach similar subject matter or even like kind of similar type of conflicts and then see what they integrate and what they don't and like how it differs from what you came up with. And that's also something that I don't normally get to nerd out in because I'm usually designing something about a conflict that doesn't have a game yet. I thought for Resist, what was so amazing to me, and you and Trevor and Roger, I'm sorry, Trevor Benjamin and Roger Taggersley, and give credit. I assume that everybody knows everybody, but that's right, just not how even a podcast works. Super oblivious of me. But yeah, like for you, Trevor and Roger, like you tackled Maquis squaring off with these Francoists in Spain with kind of emphasizing, we emphasized some of the same things, but specifically I was really impressed with how you focus on individuals pitted against the regime, and they have faces and names and professions, and it really makes it like significantly more immersive. And I was wondering if that was something that the team knew early on in the design, that we're going to focus on personal stories more than events and I'd say like a bird's eye perspective of the conflict.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it's funny if you look at the games I've worked on in the last few years that are war game or war game adjacent, almost every single one of them, no matter what systems or whatever, are like skirmish level, right? Individuals, and if they live in like, I don't know how you'd say this, like my serious war game world, right? So like Valiant Defense or whatever, they're real people. And if they live in the world of like broad targeting, like a broader, cross section of the market, like the hobby game market. So like Undaunted or Resist, it's individuals, but they're fictitious, right? So that's like, that's a very deliberate decision. But going back to like the very first conceptual sketch of what Resist was going to be, it was always going to be focused on the individuals. And it was going to be focused on that sort of like duality of the hidden versus revealed persona. And we're very fortunate, like working with Albert Montes, the artist, we're very fortunate that he's super, super talented and was be able to convey so much personality in those two illustrations about the Maquis member. And so just to kind of walk you through like the way that evolved is, the game itself, like the conceptual gameplay was mostly, I sort of conceptualized that, right? So I came to Roger and Trevor and I was like, hey, here's what I want the game to be about. And here's the sort of like framework of the gameplay. Roger led all of the theming of the individual Maquis. And so what would happen is he would basically did a bunch of research. He would come back and he'd say, okay, this is Alfonso, and he's going to be like this old bookkeeper, but when he's revealed, he's going to do blah, 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 right? And so it was essentially like the equivalent of an art brief for the artist. And so we turned that over to Albert. We said, hey, this is just a sketch. You don't have to, you know, stick to this, right? This is just a general idea. We had placeholder names, and we're fortunate that Salt and Pepper is a Spanish publisher. So you know, where we had our uninformed idiot names, right? They actually had some good, consistent, you know, historically consistent names that they were able to apply to them. So it wound up being a really good team effort of how we got to where we did, I think. But from the very beginning, we always wanted to be these sort of like personal stories and the overwhelming odds against a small, you know, group of people. But we wanted people to care about them, right?
I always think about, kind of contrast it, not to switch total gears to video games instead of tabletop. But there is like an interesting phenomenon with a lot of video games now have like these little cinematic bits, and then there's like some sort of like meaningless choices that don't really impact the story necessarily in a very meaningful way. And then I think back to like playing something like XCOM, where I got to name my squads and like send them out, and I've equipped them, and I've like given them, you know, goofy hairstyles, and I've grown attached based on their skill sets and their personalities. And anytime anything happens to them, I'm like just totally upset. Like I'm really bent out of shape over it. Yeah. But when I'm playing like this stupid like first person game with the cinematics, it's like I just want to skip every cinematic. I just like want to get this thing like let's get moving. I don't really care. And I think that's like that engagement, like the names and faces, you know, for a game that has a pretty small footprint. Resist has this incredible like artwork, and then you have your mission cards are very specific. Like everything feels pretty unique, like what within the framework of the game. And then even like having the folks that you have initially recruited, and then the folks that you have that are not in your hidden deck but they're available to recruit. Like there's a sense of like what's missing. I'll be honest, I played through the scenarios a little bit, but I really liked the random, here are my 12 people. I don't know. These are who I could get. And then there might be spies, you know, there's spies mingled in there, but then the missions just like, I don't know what missions are coming up. I don't know how their skills are going to go with it. Something about that ragtag quality felt really great to me, but I like that there's options within that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that game was like fantastic. I was really impressed. It is like trying to bring, you know, you're trying to bring some of that element of like combat commander to the masses. You know what I mean? Like that investment and that sense of, I was talking with Kai Jensen about it, and she's just like, do you imagine like a little movie when you're playing it? It's like, absolutely. Like every single time. It's like kind of the amazing part, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, and one thing real quick about the scenarios is when we originally designed the game, we designed it with the base game, the victory point threshold, and we came back to the scenarios because some people don't like beat your best score, right? Quote unquote, beat your best score. But what I think Resist has that I don't know that any of those games, or not that I've played, have is the you get to decide when you end the resistance, right? Which means it's different than all those other beat your best score games, right? So it's really this one big you push your luck, right? Is what it ultimately comes down to.
No, for sure, and I think it's really interesting thing to incorporate in a game about a resistance movement too. You know, that's one of the decisions too. Like when you're when you're trying to define like what victory is going to look like, sometimes there's almost like a sense of like, here's the points that you're accumulating and what margin of victory it is. And for other times you're like, well, how much is that is the stakes for these individuals in this? Like if I were playing like a game set and say during the Warsaw Uprising in 1944, I'm not trying to beat the spread, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty all or nothing at that point. Yeah. So it can get a little bit difficult to kind of incorporate that. I was kind of curious because you've done a lot of solitaire games, both in the kind of in the kind of more mainstreamy space, but probably fewer of those, like your Valiant Defense or solitaire. But I've noticed like you've done like the two player war games plenty of times, and you've also, or more, right, in the case of Reinforcements.
Yeah.
And then also like the games that are like solitaire. How do you decide which games you want to kind of design from a solitaire perspective and which ones you want to make multiplayer?
Yeah. Well, there's some practical bits to that, but I mean, So one real quick note about when I design a game to be multiplayer, meaning in this case two or more players, right? So like not the generic multiplayer of three or more, but two or more.
Right.
I think this is true. I've never made a solitaire version of a game that I've designed that's been a multiplayer game, right? Which is to say, Undaunted, the solitaire system, was designed by David Digby and David Turksey. The solitaire system for Sniper Elite, I did not design. So if I design a game to be multiplayer, I'm not good at turning my multiplayer game into a solitaire experience. Like, that's not... I can't do it. I can't wrap my head around that. So for one thing, this is not really your question, but just to kind of flag it real quick, is once I've made that decision, like, that's it. Like, it's either going to be a solitaire game or a multiplayer game. There's like one kind of exception to that. It would be like Pavlov's House or Switch and Signal, which are cooperative, right? But you can play them solitaire. Or in Pavlov's House, it's really a solitaire game that you can play co-op. But anyway, so to answer your question, the vast majority of the work I do is either solitaire or two-player. If it's a two-player game, usually that means I'm designing it with Trevor, my main design partner. Maybe with Roger, who's my sort of other main, right? Like, that's kind of the two guys I spend the vast majority of my time with. If it's a solitaire game, what you'll see is the people that I collaborate with that I'll list as, like, that are included as co-creators. And so that would be people like Niels Johansson for Lansworth Ridge, or Michael Cockman for Soldier and Postman Uniforms, or whatever. They're usually not like the game design co-design partner. They're usually like a co-creative that did some other major element of it. So like Michael Cockman did all the historic research for Soldiers and Postmen's Uniforms, and Niels did all the artwork and graphic design for Lansworth Ridge. But I'm kind of the opinion that if a person does like half the work on a game, regardless of what they did, their name should be front and center on the front of the box. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, so what you'll basically see is if it's me doing a solitaire game from leading the design part, that's like my solo game design work. But if it's me doing a two-player game, then I'll do it with somebody else as splitting the design work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
And a lot of that's purely practical, right? Like, it's, you know, it's easier for me. Now, there is an exception with Resist, right, where Roger and Trevor and I all worked on it together, and that's just sort of a side story about how that evolved into that. But usually, if I'm doing it the design solo, it's a solo game, and if I do the design cooperatively, it's a two or more, you know, game.
Okay. That's interesting. I had assumed it had something to do with the player roles a little bit, I guess, because you've, you know, for example, like in Resist, obviously, like the fascists are in a player role, right? It's not like a playable angle. So because it's not a player POV, the idea seemed like, oh, well, yeah, you make it solitaire to kind of navigate around that. And
so now that is also true. That's also goes into it. I'm not going to play a game where, like, Soldiers and Postmen's Uniform is the most obvious example. Like, and because so. For people that don't know the Valiant Defense series, sometimes I include a variant of the game that allows you to play against the opponent. It's not really a two-player game, so I don't like calling it a two-player. It's really there to design for you to teach your friend how to play the game. It gives you something to do while you're teaching it, which is just kind of control the AI. It's not really great, right? I would not recommend that as a two-player experience for that series, but you can do it. I don't allow for that in Soldiers and Postmen's Uniform because I absolutely refuse to let the player take the role of the god-awful actions that were taken by the SS in that game, right? In the SA and the Danzig City Police. Like, it's just, I'm not making a game where you can do that. And that is kind of true for Resist, right? Like, I didn't really want to put the role in a player in the role of the Francoists that were going out in some cases, like the counter-guerrillas were posing as the Maquis and committing all sorts of atrocities. Like, I'm not going to do that. So that also plays into it, right?
Yeah. No, and I could understand that for a lot of practical reasons, from everything from, you should design games you would want to play, I think seems to be at the forefront of those considerations. And then, I think there's an element of... as someone who designs a lot of games where there's a deplorable side, sometimes more than one, that I let players be, it's like if that player role wasn't going to be informative in any way, I probably wouldn't let people play it. Like if there was nothing to really show or do.
Yep.
But then it's just sort of like this kind of gross misery simulator. And I think that for, you know, like designing that, even getting back to kind of like the designing for a resistance movement versus like, you know what I mean, some authoritarian or Nazi or fascist, you know, kind of player role. It's like through the solitaire, you can kind of illuminate certain aspects of the resistance movement that are a little bit more difficult to do in even a highly asymmetric two-player game, probably. But right. When you make that a player role, it's like you really need to like earn that's a player role. Like, what are you trying to tell people about it and show them and things like that? So that's definitely a bit more daunting to justify it.
I think that's true. I mean, I think there's also a little bit of, even if you did allow the play, let's take Resist, right? Like, let's say you design a game where, you know, there's a resistance movement against, I mean, let's be honest, the Spanish Maquis were not going to liberate Spain. There's no world where that happens, right? So, like, what does the, I think it's fine to put the player in the position of the resistant movement and say, do as well as you can, right? And, like there's, you can come out of that feeling like, wow, we did all these amazing things. We accomplished all of this. We did great, right? What is the Francoist player doing? Like, you didn't completely destroy the resistance. Like, what is your win condition in that
right.
Scenario too, right?
Yeah. No, it's tougher to identify what the margin of victory is going to be unless you're trying to, and also you're not really illuminating like a new, oh, I can't believe that's incentivized. Like, I never understood that was why they were trying to suppress this movement. Like, it's just a little bit more difficult, right?
Yeah.
That was sort of the thing, too, that, you know, like, looking at it from the, when we're doing our little concept game jam game for the French, you know, like, I always call it resistance in France because the French resistance wasn't really that French, but I'm going to get a bunch of bad mail now. But I think it's interesting to me, like part of what I wanted to highlight was that the folks who were kind of in the vanguard of that resistance movement were the people who had nothing to lose because they'd already, you know, had to flee Nazis previously in a lot of cases. And they're just like, it was their ass on the line. That's why they're first out. And for the occupation, I wanted to highlight that the occupation wasn't just Germans. It's like collaborating French too. You know what I mean? Like, and this idea of like, there's a complicitness with the occupation and while you're doing it at the same time. But man, like a lot of these things aren't really going to be that nuanced. Like, it's just bad people doing bad things. And it's like hard to drum up a lot of desire to design a game where it's just like, oh, we're going to do that. And then afterwards, when players are like, I don't want to do that, you're like, yeah, I get it. No, it's not great. Like, I get it, you know, and with how much there is to play, like how many games that there are, like people should probably spend time playing things where they're doing things that they wouldn't actually want to do or things that they're going to actually learn from. But if it's neither of those things, then it's just a little weird, right? It's just kind of an odd use of time.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think, you know, you're very prolific. I always tell anybody who comes up to me and asks me, like, how long it takes to design games or, like, you know, about how long should I spend researching for a game, I always tell them, for a CDG, it takes me about 2 years and David Thompson will be finished with a game by the end of this sentence. Because it seems usually about how that feels. Like, they're just kind of cracking out there. And sort of thing. And maybe that's in part because you collaborate with a lot of folks. So I think, like, with collaborations, that can certainly accelerate the process. But I was going to ask you, like, when you're co-designing, do you have kind of defined roles, like, within your kind of partnerships for designs? Or is it more or less like kind of a design by committee?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, first of all, every single design partnership is super different, right? Now, that's, I mean, that's a very cliche thing to say, but it's also super true. And so I don't think I've ever had a design partnership where at the outset we sat down and said, you're going to do X and I'm going to do Y. It's never been that. Now, there's people who I've worked with so much that we absolutely now organically have it that exists, right? And so let me give you an example. When I'm working with Trevor on something, 100% of the time, he is now going to keep all the notes. I'm going to make all the TTS mod stuff. You know, I'm more going to be responsible for like the thematic stuff. He's going to be more responsible for all of the like refinement. He's the sort of voice that's going to keep us streamlining when there's an opportunity to streamline, et cetera. Right. So all of that stuff, we've never actually had a conversation. I mean, now maybe we will say like, oh, you do this, I do this, whatever. But we never sat down and had that conversation, but we've designed together for like 5 years now. And we see each other usually either two or three times a week for a couple hours each time. So, I mean, we spend a lot of time together. Right. So, now the other, like the more, let's give a more recent example of somebody I worked with for the first time. So Jeff Engelstein asked to work on Zheng He, right? So we've never worked together. We don't really know each other. We met in person like once briefly, chatted a couple of times. So we don't know anything about either, you know, each other at all. And so that was, we did not have a conversation about who's going to be responsible for what. We did kind of, like, it evolved during the course of the design, but it was never stated like, hey, you're going to do this and I'm going to do that. It just kind of got there. So probably that, you know, if the best situation to probably do would be to actually have like an initial conversation where you sketch out, hey, these are my strengths. These are your strengths. Let's do this stuff. Let's be efficient. But game design's not like, none of the people I've ever worked with do game design as their full-time job. With the exception of Dave Neal, who I'm working with on a game right now, who's doing it full-time. So, like, game design for me is not about... I don't really want to turn it into my job, which means I don't want to care about things like efficiency and all that, right? I just want to, like, hang out with people and drink beer and design games. And so I would rather just kind of get together and spend time and hang out and have fun and let things kind of flow how they will.
That makes sense. I mean, like, we've got jobs, you know what I mean? Yeah. you think about that, especially when you're trying to turn something you enjoy into a little job. And you're just like, well, how jobby do I want to get with this? I don't want to go overboard, but it makes sense too. Cause like you're, I'm sorry. I was going to say I think like when you're collaborating with people, you're doing it as much because you kind of want to hang out with them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And within the framework of like, hey, let's work on this thing. That'd be like a fun thing to do, but it's not really like a necessarily like a savvy thing or, oh, like this game, this project really needs the two of us like to take a crack at it together and combine our forces. But every once in a while, I'm sure you see like the opportunity to kind of mentor someone who doesn't really know that much about the industry, like kind of like what you're doing with Jeff, right? Like he's never made a game before. Like this is his first, yes, this is his first foray into this wild world of game design. And he just doesn't, you know, just like a rube, he just has no idea what's going on. So this is like an opportunity for you to do a little hand-holding and kind of like show him how things work. Like, these are dice, Jeff, dice. You can incorporate these in the game. And these are cards. And yeah, we can do like something with that. So well, that's great. I think it's a great public service that you're doing there. It's going to be good.
No, yeah. So, absolutely. Right. I mean, I am 100%, again, very cliche, 100% in the hobby because of the people, right? Like my favorite things to do are go to conventions and meet people that have played my games, or I spend way too much time on Facebook groups like the Solitaire War Game group or on BGG, hanging out, you know, chatting with people or whatever. You know, my schedule is I usually wake up around 4:30 and I usually work on game design until about 6:30 or so, right? So I usually have 2 hours in the morning set aside to work on game design. And the vast majority of that time is not spent on game design. It's answering questions on groups, and it's like engaging people and stuff. And so, you know, through some formal things like the Zenobia Award, I do a lot of mentorship, but a lot of the time people will just reach out to me on Facebook groups or whatever and ask questions that range from anything from like, you know, design questions, but most of it's like industry questions. Like, can you tell me about this publisher? Can you help me out with a contract question or whatever? And that's like, I mean, it's just awesome, right? I feel super blessed to be able to just kind of be in part of us. It's like, it's just this awesome little community, right? Where everybody's accessible. So yeah, it's fun.
That's definitely like what I like about the historical game corner of it more than the wider kind of industry, because it just felt like, oh crap, I can just go to this event and then meet these people and ask them like my idiot questions, and if they're nice, they'll just answer them for me. That's weird. Like, they really shouldn't allow me in this building, let alone like to ask them these stupid questions, you know? But it was just like really interesting to like just be able to, you know, set up like a game at some con, get some folks like come take a look at it, and you can get publishers to look at stuff, but just like also being able to just get insight from like some of the other designers and get tips, and you know, sometimes like without them even playing a game, you know how it is, like you'll be able to just I'm just looking at your thing, let me just point out four things that you should probably take a second swing at, and it's just like very valuable, you know. But I think that's the cool thing about this corner of the hobby versus when you're, you know, if you were gonna design like your next Gloomhaven type of thing, and you're showing up to Origins with your like massive boxes of stuff, trying to like demo it for people and show it. It's just like, it's a lot more daunting, I think, to like go into that type of an environment, see if you can get some sort of like feedback on what you've made.
Yeah. I mean, I spent, you know, when I first started thinking about, I wanted to be a game designer. I was living in the UK, and I spent 4 years since this is like very first, I want to be a game designer, I want to make games. That would have been 2014. And from 2014 to 2018, I went to Essen every year. So that was the main thing. I went to Nuremberg, I think once or twice. I went to UK Game Expo, etc. And I was doing kind of what you're describing, where I would design a bunch of games, like conceptualize them, make the prototype, take it to Essen, pitch to a bunch of publishers, and it was like, at the time I was like, I guess this is what being a game designer is. And for many game designers, it still is, right? Especially ones that live in that world of like Euro game design, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And man, I don't want any part of that anymore. Like, I haven't made a game to pitch to a publisher. Like, I'm just going to think of a game and maybe one day I'll pitch it to a publisher. Like, I very, very, very seldom do that now. I mean, now part of this is I'm super blessed. Like, War Chest, AG, I'll make War Chest expansions or Undaunted, blah, 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 right? A Valiant Defense. But a lot of it is just like, we're in a position in the historical game / war game part of the hobby where if you make a good game about an interesting topic, like, there is a publisher for you, right? It's not this world where you may never get your game published. You may design it and pitch it to 30 different Euro game publishers and nobody wants it or whatever. It really is in our corner, the historical war game corner of the hobby, it really is much more about like the personal relationships you have with publishers, designers, etc. And it's just like, oh, I want to make a game on, like, Liz Davidson and I are working together on our game about the Night Witches. We technically don't have a publisher, but the game will get published, right? Like, right. There's zero concern that we're not going to find somebody that's interested in our, you know, our community of publishing people that we know. So we have there's this peace of mind that we can just make the game we want to make and we'll find a publisher for it. Right. It's just a very, very, it's almost like two different industries, right? Within our little industry, there's two different industries and they work completely different.
Completely different. Yeah. No, I totally agree. So having designed like everything from, you know, you're co-designing like War Chest and you've done Switch and Signal, and then you've got like your Valiant Defense and a lot of your other kind of war game stuff. So in the course of designing all those games, you've worked with a lot of different publishers. How do you identify the right publisher for a given project?
So it depends. Some of my more recent stuff that are like the unusual things, like Sniper Elite, was commissioned, right? So Rebellion came to me and asked me to design it. I've got another game that I'm working on right now that's like my main project, that's a similar thing. A publisher came to me and commissioned it. I don't do a lot of that, right? So a lot of the stuff that I spend time with are games, again, like Undaunted. I will put out an Undaunted game probably a year for as long as people buy Undaunted. So a lot of it's my time is already accounted for at this point. Let's say that I was going to make a solitaire war game about whatever topic, you pick a topic. Even if it's not Valiant Defense, I'm probably just going to have DVG publish it, right? Because I have such a good relationship with them. I know everything mm-hmm. about it, blah, blah, blah. Now, there are some publishers that I just want an opportunity to work with at some point. Like we talked about Jim. Like Jim and I, you know, this Jim and I had talked about Europe Divided, about him publishing that when he was with Jolly Roger, right? And it was during the time of Ultra Pro and all of that stuff, and so it just didn't work out. But I'd love to work with Jim. I'd love to have a game published by Holland Spiel at some point, etc. So there are some publishers that just like we were just talking about, like the people, I want to work with the people. So that's, if I had more time, you know, I would be designing games for them. So it's this weird thing of like managing my free time between commissions, games that I'm sort of almost obligated to work on because they're part of series. Like the Valiant Defense is a good example of that, right? Dan wants us to have at least one game of the series a year. So it's just kind of balancing all those sorts of obligations and also wanting to work with specific publishers. Now, having said that, there's certain publishers I've got a game coming out. So I have two games that are not Undaunted related games that are on contract with Osprey. I can't really talk about them, but they were really good fits for Osprey because of the types of games they were, in my opinion. There's a lot of benefits with working with a publisher like Osprey. They are, more than any other publisher I've ever worked with, they are an absolute fine old machine. They're going to prioritize production quality. They're going to prioritize art quality, all these things. So if I'm conceptualizing a game that I think has broader appeal, right, like a broader market appeal, and I value those elements of it, then I'm going to pitch to maybe Osprey. If mm-hmm. it's a game that has no war game ties at all, and I think it might have broader appeal, I might pitch to AEG. If it's hyper niche, super crazy solitaire war game, I'm probably going to get DVG to print it. You know, so it's just all about knowing the strengths of the publisher, which part of the market they appeal to, that kind of stuff.
That's interesting. I definitely can relate to the having your kind of bucket list of folks you want to work with. I mean, do a game with. And then you keep that in the back of your mind, even when you don't really have necessarily like a running project list kind of going. But it sounds like a lot of your time is already kind of accounted for with like projects like throughout the year. So if you can get one thing, like if you had an idea, then it's just like, oh crap, how am I?
Yeah.
Well, am I gonna fit this in?
I mean, so all kidding aside, like right now, so it's 2022. I'm pretty much scheduled out until about 2025, right? Projects that are on contract, in work, have delivery dates, etc. But like, you know, I mentioned Resist in passing. So Resist came from the guy who owns Salt and Pepper. He had reached out and he obviously is a publisher, but he also is a historical gamer, and he's a Spanish guy, reviewed a lot of my games, and he said, hey, I just really want to work with you. And I felt horrible because for like 2 years he said, I really want you to do a game for me. You can do a game about anything you want to do, just do a game for me. And I was like, man, I don't have time. And I think he thought I was like blowing him off, but I was like, I literally don't have time to make a game. And so this weird circumstance of event arose where I had like a month or two where I didn't have anything. Like I'd finished a couple of projects and for whatever reason, I couldn't start on a couple. And so that's why I reached out to Trevor Roger. And I was like, hey, are either of you interested in working on this crazy project? Well, we've got to get it done fast. Like it has to be breakneck speed. You know, we have a 2 month window to get the entire design done. But yeah, I mean, it's literally like, it kills me because I've all, we all do. Like every designer has their list of, you know, 50 designs they want to work on. But it kills me to, like, I've had the Night Witches written down as a game I want to work on for like 4 years now. And it's always at the bottom of the list because it's not on contract. So I don't have a, you know, it has to just kind of take back seat. So, yeah.
But that's where it probably helps to have like a co-designer to kind of be able to do something with it who has a little bit less on their plate. Like even when that task is a matter of like, are you reading? Like, are you doing a little bit of reading or are you doing like a little bit of this kind of guided research in this direction?
Yeah.
Versus like a, if it was all with you, it would be a lot harder to get that kind of.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing about one of the biggest benefits of having a co-designer is it forces you to keep yourself held accountable. Right. So like Liz and I have a meeting next Tuesday or Thursday morning. I have to come to that meeting with what we talked about I was going to do the last time we met. So it forces me to be held accountable. Because otherwise, if it was just me, it was like, well, you know, it's not on contract. It's just me. There's no harm in me not doing it. So I just won't work on it right now. So, yeah, that's one of the big benefits of having a design partner for sure.
The sense of obligation.
Yeah.
The weight on your conscience when you don't make the progress you're supposed to make when you said you were going to make it.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Yep. You know, that sounds very real to me. That actually sounds like probably one of the biggest assets from that. Even more so than the a lot of us pushing in the same direction. Because sometimes we're not, right? We're actually pushing in different directions. But it really does help to know that I'm disappointing someone other than myself when I don't meet a deadline or meet some sort of benchmark. I definitely find that stuff helpful.
Yeah, and your point about pushing in different directions, like one thing about that is, you know, there's benefits to having co-designers. There's also benefits with working with the same person a lot, whether the person you already know really well and have a good relationship with and feel comfortable with, or you just establish that over time because you continue to collaborate. Because, I mean, I'll just be honest, like, you know, when Jeff and I started working on Zheng He, I'm more resistant to providing complete, frank feedback to Jeff than I would be to Trevor right now, right? Like, I don't know Jeff. I don't know how he's going to receive this. We've never worked together before, et cetera, et cetera. Not saying that happened in Zheng He, but just as an example, if I had a major issues, I might be less, you know, more reluctant to voice my full, frank opinion about something. But once you've worked with a person and you understand each other and you trust each other and you have that relationship built up, you can cut out a lot of the like niceties and all that stuff. And you're like, dude, this is stupid. Like we've got to, you know, this is insanity. This is crap. You know, let's move on. So that's just one, you know, just taking sort of the benefits of co-design to the next sort of level of the benefits of establishing a really trusting relationship with a person, you know, over time.
Yeah, figuring out how to frame your feedback is an important part of that, because it's not just constructive. You want to guide it towards where you want it to go a little bit, and they're doing the same thing.
That's a whole separate thing. Yeah. That's an interesting, like, that's a whole, I mean, we could talk about this stuff forever. Like, because then as a person, you have to be true to yourself about, okay, I have a goal. I have what I think is the right direction. But the challenge to that is you have to be open-minded, right? You need to come into this collaboration thinking, well, yeah, I think I probably know the best solution, but I have to be open-minded and I have to listen and really think about what the other person is saying, because maybe that is a better solution, right? So that's a challenge. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like self-reflection that goes into it and really understanding your own strengths and weaknesses, and all that comes into the co-design process too.
I would think when you're working with the same co-designers across multiple projects, one of the advantages is you're picking up where you left off in a weird way, even though the project changed. Your communique is about where you left off with them. Whereas when you switch collaborators, but you in your heart have a different outlook on collaboration in general.
Yeah.
In the overall design sphere, it's sometimes hard to kind of come back around to where, like, now I'm trying to communicate with a totally different person, and like maybe they're not as cool with my blunt criticism sometimes, especially when it's not any better founded than it was 2 years ago in this other collaboration. The difference is just like I'm more used to giving it. That's kind of where we're at.
Well, that's true. And I mean, man, it is all about getting to know the person. So the roles you might have in one relationship will change based on the other person. So here's, we've been talking about it a lot, but the two guys I work with the most, Trevor Benjamin. So we should just, we assume a lot of things. So Trevor Benjamin and I have worked together on the Undaunted series, War Chest, Resist, etc. Roger Tankersley and I started working together more recently, though I've known him for many years. We're coworkers and good friends. But we worked together on Sniper Elite and Resist, and we've got another game coming out soon. So what's interesting about that is when Trevor and I are working on a game, I will take the more thematic lead. I'll take I'll usually do a lot of the conceptualization, thematic lead. We kind of share the gameplay stuff. He's going to do a lot of the refinement. He's going to do all the sort of bookkeeping, etc. So if there's a spectrum, right, I flip that with Roger because he's more thematic than I am, but I've sort of taken a lot of the refinement lessons from Trevor. So I actually switch roles in that relationship. So it's just an interesting thing where if you're going to be successful, you really have to find your strengths and weaknesses, not just for yourself, but relative to the partner you're with. Right.
Yeah. That's the part where game design feels a little bit more similar to, before this, like making music and like collaborating with other musicians, where it's just every once in a while you'll work with someone who's just like, do you even listen to other people in the room? Are you just listening to yourself? Because that's not great. And I think that's it's kind of an interesting skill set that you see like in some designers, where you can kind of tell how they're processing. They're working around other people like a little bit, but also like reflecting back like, oh, they need to know this. Specifically, and like when I was working with Joe Schmidt on In the Shadows, he's got like this kind of drummer's mentality, I would call it, because drummers can't help but listen to other people in the room. They just have to be listening. There's just that, or there's terrible drummers. There's like really no third thing, so like he would just really be good about taking the process of the idea, and even if it's an idea he's a little bit resistant to early on, we get like in the conversation like 20 minutes on, he's got the idea that's gonna make that suggestion I had like 1,000 times better, and like it'll just like freaking nail it. And that's the thing that you really need in that, as that sounding board, is someone who's just not just gonna be buckle when you come into conflict with them on an idea, but also like someone who can just be like, well, I can improve your shitty idea right now. Just do this, just do that. And they're like, yeah, no, we're golden. That's perfect. But yeah, no, I think that it's really impressive to be able to do so many projects where you're navigating that, like with that kind of those kind of relationships, not just with the same group of co-designers, but easily kind of folding in like new collaborators all the time and continuing to work. I think that's like really cool. So I've just been really impressed with that. And especially playing so many of your games and like seeing like how, who's on this box now? who's doing this one with David? It's very cool.
Yeah. Well, I said it before, but it's true. It's the best part, right? So before we got together tonight, I spent 4 hours about 3 hours with Trevor, and then another hour with Trevor and Roger working on other games. And it's like, this is awesome. It can be frustrating, right? Like, so the project that Trevor and I are working on right now, that was that commission project I mentioned, we're at a very frustrating stage where we're kind of going back and forth with the publisher and their developers and stuff. And we're kind of struggling with the core. But then Roger came in with a project that we're all three working on together, and it's just like, man, we're like hitting, all cylinders. And so, I mean, that's another thing about having so many projects and work at any given point is like, when you're struggling with one, it's nice to have something that you're feeling really good about to keep you motivated. And excited.
Yeah. I think back to like starting out in design and only having one project, and I don't know how I did that.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I, you know, if you said I can only work on one thing, I'd be like, well, I don't want to work on anything then. That's crazy. Yeah, mm-hmm. That would drive me insane. I've got the other problem, as you could probably imagine. I'm like trying to jam as many possible things into as little bit of time as I can, and it's sometimes it gets overwhelming, right?
I ask designers all the time, do you have like a whale, like this big project that you work on a little bit over the course of years that's just like, I don't know if this is ever going to get done, but it's sort of like the passion project that you're just like never sure what's going to be made of it?
Well, not anymore. I mean, the project that was the closest to that, but it had to be worked on was Undaunted Stalingrad for sure. I mean, I don't know that I'll ever work on anything that was as intense just from a sheer like cognitive load, right? From a design perspective as it was, right? Just, it was not just in sheer amount of content, but the way in which the content is tied together in the game, because it is basically this, it's like a legacy game. It's resettable, but it operates as a legacy game. And there, the ties, the flow chart, if you will, I guess, that ties everything together was so insane. So but it was on a deadline. So we had to finish it, right? So it couldn't just be something that we could just kind of slowly pick apart. We had to get it done. But yeah, I've said that it was the game that almost killed us. And like, I do feel like some days I definitely lost a lot of brain cells when we were working on it.
Yeah. I drink when I design too. I didn't think it helps.
I have, for I mean, sure. I think it's like an actual medical condition I have. I call myself a game design alcoholic because I only really drink when I'm working on game design. Like I'll drink, you know, usually I'm drinking a beer, maybe scotch or whatever. So I don't drink much. But like when I'm working on game design, I'm drinking. I'm like, I think this is probably a problem.
Like that whole time.
Yeah.
I used to have a friend that during band practice, she would drink a lot more than normal. And I'd be like, what are you doing? And she'd be like, well, this is what I'm practicing. Yeah, because I'm going to be drinking in this show. I want to make sure that I can keep it together here in practice. She's a very bad influence on the rest of us, I have to say. But yeah. So final question. What have you been playing lately that you've been excited about? Have you gotten a chance to play anything lately? You seem pretty busy in general, but...
Yeah. Curious. I don't play a ton. I play every once in a while. I'll get together with some of my buddies on Tabletop Simulator and we'll play stuff. Usually that kind of stuff is like... the group tends to have like a preference towards area majority kind of games, like a Blood Rage or whatever. I like Tyrants of the Underdark. I think it's really cool. El Grande is probably my favorite all-time game, right? So when I'm playing with that group of friends, that's the kind of stuff we'll play. Otherwise, I have a local group that has like one guy that's into the same kind of historical and war games that I have, but our deck or our pile of two-player games is just continuing to grow. We haven't met in a while. So like I got, Vin Mansim's Triumph, just got it in the mail, but I haven't played it yet, of course, but I'm super excited about it. But, most of my actual legit gameplay is with my kids. So I just picked up Under Falling Skies. Do you know it? It's a solo game. Yeah.
Love the art on that.
I know, it's cool. Yeah, it's cool. It's cool. One thing I do a lot with my kid, look, I'll play family games with them. We play a lot of social deduction stuff or whatever. But with my youngest, my son who's 8 and my daughter who's 11, I oftentimes will play solitaire games co-op. So we've played Warp's Edge, Under Falling Skies now, that kind of stuff. We'll just get together and we'll like kind of co-op it together. So that's what we've been playing lately.
Do you think that's like a big part of like design? I mean, for me personally, like I would find it really hard to design projects if I didn't have an equal or greater amount of time spent playing things, if that makes sense. Like it's really hard to like imagine designing without having that opportunity to play with other people.
Yeah, that's a really good, I mean, oof, man. So So obviously the solitaire stuff I design the way, like, so for my Valiant Defense games, I almost never play them, right? Like, I don't think I've ever taken one of them out and played it by myself after it's been published. Now, I will demo them, I'll meet with people and show them, that kind of stuff. But, like, for me to say, I'm going to take Pavlov's House off the shelf and play it, like, that just doesn't happen. But I get a massive amount of satisfaction of interacting with the solitaire community, right? So, like, the satisfaction I might get with playing a different game or one of my own games with a group or whatever, I certainly get that by interacting with the solitaire community. The honest fact is the vast majority of the time I have allocated to games, right? Just like in total, the vast majority of that is designing. By far, right? Like I probably spend, other than with my kids, right? With my kids, I usually play like once a game, maybe every other day or something. But if we don't count my kids, I maybe spend about 4 to 6 hours a month, maybe playing games, right? Very little. So it's the vast majority is it's designing. And with the exception of being like in the beginning of December, I'm going to go on a vacation and I'll have 4 days of nothing but gaming with, you know, six other people, that kind of stuff. But that's the, and of course conventions and stuff. But even at conventions, I don't really play, right? I'm usually demoing or whatever. Well, I have like work conventions and play conventions. So like Gen Con, Essen, those are not, I'm not going there to play games, right? Like I don't even kid myself. But Origins, you know, is mostly, well, the last Origins I went to was the entire time all I did was play games. I didn't take any meetings, didn't pitch any games. And a lot of that is a byproduct of what we talked about before, where I'm, like I said, you know, I'm super blessed, but I just don't pitch games anymore, right? Like everything's kind of, I don't have to go to conventions and stress that. And so I'll go to, if a publisher wants me to go to a convention, like go to Gen Con and demo, I love doing that. That's great. I get to meet a bunch of people, but otherwise I actually get to go to conventions and enjoy conventions now, which is super awesome.
That sounds great. I envy that a little bit, but at the same time, I mean, don't you think you're missing out on pitching? Like, isn't it just a joy?
Nope. Not one bit. Not a single good thing about that. I mean, now that is the only, there is only one negative. I mean, you're going to not by necessity, by whatever, by the side effect of not pitching is there's publishers you won't meet, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there, I might have relationships that I'll never establish now because I'm not pitching as much, but I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair trade-off. I think you're making out like a bandit overall. it's one of the treats of when you're designing for like topics that don't really, you just don't have like a super big audience. So as a result, you're just trying to find like who can withstand releasing this with minimal damage to themselves or like minimal losses as possible. It's like who would be willing to take on that type of a project? And then sometimes it's also just a matter of the project that you're trying to do is like you have this vision of like how it would be this this game that would open up, like to open a new audience or like broaden, like, you know, water gaming or whatever. But it's just like the publisher's just like, yeah, you should come back to us when you've got like a gimme. Like, I would really love, I'd like to see a bulge game. If you could bring me a bulge game, that would be great.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, and then there are publishers like Kevin Bertram, right, with Fort Circle, who are doing a really good job. I mean, obviously, you know, we'll see. But based on the early returns for Shores of Triple, he's done a fantastic job of taking, I mean, come on, this is a pretty niche topic, right? And he's gotten it out there. He's done a really good job. And so you have publishers who are willing to take on a relatively niche topic, but because of the way they approach their marketing and the quality of the publication and art and all of that stuff, they're able to get it out more broadly than you would otherwise think, right?
Right.
So that's there too. And then Fort Circle's another publisher that because of that, because of the way he supports his games and the way he approaches the industry in general, I would love to work with in the future, right? Just, again, another awesome relationship to have.
I think always looking for folks who are open to releasing, like, historical games that aren't necessarily, like, military conflict-focused all the time, which is funny because when you when you phrase it like that on Twitter, certain war gamers just view that as like a you hate war games type of thing. Because I thought that there might be a game that could be released that wouldn't be a war game. I just spitball on there, but I guess that would make someone really angry. But I think that it's good to see things like Votes for Women coming out, or like Nicaea, like that. That's, you know, a lot of people's. I think a lot of the allure to something like Hallenspiel is just that there's these games on like historical topics that could come out that don't really have, we think that there would be an audience for it, and it's not necessarily the war game audience. But part of, I think, expanding the hobby, this corner of the hobby even, is just like showing, hey, we could make historical games that aren't just about, you know, military history, for example, and stuff like that. And that's why I'm like super excited to see a lot of the things that are going to be coming out in the next couple of years. And, you know, thinking back to like what the hobby even looked like 5 years ago, it's just like a very different space now. Like, you can already see the dominoes.
It's very difficult for me sometimes. I mean, this is true of everybody, right? But I think about this, I try to think about it consciously, but it's difficult for me, obviously, to separate my perception of where the hobby's going versus like where I live in the hobby, right? Mm-hmm. So is it just what I'm seeing because that's what I want to be surrounded by? But I feel similar to you. Like, I feel like in the last few years, at least the community that we sort of run with, there's been a really heavy push towards diversity, like the diversity of creators, diversity of topics, like what you're talking about, and like diversity of like gameplay approaches to the stuff that we're working on, right? And so, I mean, in many things, like those, there's a lot of overlap there, right? Like, imagine this: if we increase the diversity of the creators, they're going to be bringing fresh new ideas, both in terms of the topic and how they approach it. That's probably a really good thing. But I mean, related to that, what we're seeing, I think, not in the wargame side, on the historical non-wargaming world, is we're seeing like these topics being explored from a more critical approach than what we had, where we saw ostensibly historical games that were really just Euros with pasted on theme, right? So it's just a much more interesting, and I mean, I'm not, that's where I want to see more exploration personally, right? Like, Votes for Women is probably my most anticipated game right now. I got the chance to play it at Origins. It was definitely my favorite thing I played there. I'm super excited about it, and I want to see that part of our hobby grow big time. I'm interested in exploring it myself. It's not as, for me, it's not as, it's more difficult for me to conceptualize some of that, right? So that's just a, because I've got whatever it is, 43 years of life experience and how I've designed games and my background, my professional background, all of that stuff, it's easier for me to model direct conflict conceptually than it is, you know, other topics. But for, as a player, that's definitely what I want to see more of.